It says it wants me to reintroduce myself and let you know that there's going to be a break after I'm done talking. So again, my name is No Chill Charles, and I am an alcoholic. I have a 10. Oh, my sobriety date is 8/23/2015, and they call me No Chill Charles because I have a hard time not saying what's on my mind. You know, I'm old school. I don't beat around the bush. It's the way I was raised. Some people like it. Some people don't. I like the nickname though. It's pretty cool. It's grown on me. So I'll qualify myself a little bit. I don't remember how old I was when I had my first beer, but I remember my first drunk. I was 8, and it was in Butterfield, Arkansas. It was on a river, and it was Budweiser, and it was hot, and it was gross. But I drank it because my aunt asked my brother and I if we wanted a beer. My brother said yes, so I followed suit. Halfway through the first can, you know, and this is Missouri, so it's near, or Arkansas, so it's near beer, so it's not even like, doesn't even have a high alcohol volume in it. But I started feeling all warm and fuzzies, stories that we've all heard, and most of us have had that feeling as well. And you know, like, all my concerns or worries, you know, kind of just went away. Little going backwards, I was raised in a drug addict and alcoholic home. There was a lot of violence. There was a lot of drugs. There was a lot of alcohol. And there was always a party. I grew up around the Hells Angels, so there was there's that picture. So I found that alcohol was great, and it was great until, like, on the way home, I remember getting sick and, like, really sick, like. And they pulled over, I was throwing up, and I don't remember stopping throwing up until I woke up the next morning and I was awake. Like, I just passed out, blacked out. That didn't keep me from drinking. About a year later, some things happened in my life that I didn't want to remember, and I remembered the feeling I felt down by the river. I was not eating cheese in a van, but I remember the feeling of alcohol. You know, Chris Farley, he's pretty cool. And so I went back to alcohol, and I did what they talk about in chapter 3. Between the ages of 9 and 12, I switched from not scotch to brandy, but from, you know, beer to hard alcohol, because I couldn't drink beer anymore. Like, one drink, just one sip, and I would get sick, but I wouldn't get drunk. So that was like, that wasn't working for me. So I started drinking Southern Comfort, and that worked really well. I did that until my 12th birthday. My brother made me drink a 6-pack of Heineken, and then I could drink beer again. It was great. Like, everything was lining up. Like, I could drink whatever I wanted, and I could drink until I threw up, and I could drink some more. And then when I passed out, I would do it again the next day. So my drinking went on up until the age of 28. I drank as often as I could. There's some other substances that ran in the mix there. Won't talk about them here today, but if you want to know more, you can ask me outside. Definitely a part of my story. So 28, I stopped drinking, not because I wanted to, and not because I was ready, but the state of Oregon decided to put me in this place that, you know, you can't leave. And I got to stay there for almost 2 years. You know, it was, I was a dry drunk. I was going to AA meetings. You know, I was there because I wanted it to look good on paper when I got out. You know, I wanted my parole officer to be like, yeah, this guy changed. But I did have an aha moment in county, and I was like, you know, I might have a problem with drinking. And the fire chief brought me an AA book, you know, a big book, and I read a little bit of it. But, while I was in prison, I couldn't get a sponsor because it would have had to have been another inmate, and you know, you can't trust those guys. So, that was my excuse for not getting a sponsor while incarcerated. When I got out of prison, I started going to meetings, I took on commitments, I got a sponsor, and I half-assed started to work the steps with this guy. And then my son's mom passed away, and I ended up with him full-time, and I stopped going to meetings, and he told me that was dangerous. You know, he said, I'm not going to tell you how to do your recovery, but you need to go to meetings or you're going to end up getting drunk. Well, I got a resentment. And then 2 weeks later, I got drunk. Imagine that. Like, I believe somewhere in the book it says resentments are the number one offender. And I'm, you know, proof that that is true, at least in my case. So, you know, I was drinking again. It wasn't every day, but I was drinking again. Mind you, I'm out on a 90-day trans leave. I still had almost 10 months hanging over my head. I'm now my child's only parent, and I'm drinking again, you know. And it wasn't long, and like I was right back to the amount that I was drinking again, you know, regardless of happening to test. Because I was real smart, you know, I would drink Thursday night because I knew they weren't in on Fridays, and then I didn't have to test again until Monday, so I could get away with it. Thursday night, I could tie one off, and I did. I met a girl at church who said she was in the program, and so I told her I was too. I'd be on the phone with her. She was in the next town over, and I'd be drinking and talking to her about the stars and recovering. I don't even remember because I was drunk, but she bought it, so whatever. But anyway, August 22nd, 2015, I was at a wedding, at my boss's wedding, and I mean, I was, you know, I did what I normally did. I started out with beer, and then I went to hard alcohol. And then I started, you know, I was the only one wanting to play with the kids, so we started jumping over tables and playing like Rambo and Army and stuff, and it was great until I got sick again. And so I'm sitting there, and I'm hugging the toilet, and I'm throwing up, and my son's in my boss's bed because I kicked my boss out of his room, and I had my moment of clarity, like, what are you doing? Like, you know, like, my son's mom just passed away. I'm on parole, and like, this little human is like depending on me, like, and he needs me now more than ever. He's not the reason I'm sober today, but he was definitely enough of an eye-opener, a wake-up. So this girl that I'd been lying to, I called her the next morning and told her I relapsed, which, you know, it's great. So she invited me to a meeting, and I was like, yeah, let's do this. And it was at St. Timothy's in Brookings, Oregon, and it was on a Tuesday night, and I went, and I stood up when they said anyone in their first 30 days, and I said, you know, the wedding was on a Saturday, so I had, 3 days, and they welcomed me, and after the meeting, you know, I'm standing next to her, and this guy walks up to me, and he sticks his hand out, and says, hey, my name's Pat, are you done drinking? I said, absolutely, and he said, yeah, do you want to, you know, work the steps? And I'm like, of course, you know. I'm trying to impress this girl, right? And, you know, he doesn't give me his number, but he asked me for mine, and I gave it to him. And the next day he was at my house, and we started on step one. And we were going through the steps, and he never told me how to do it. He never told me I was doing it wrong. He gave me suggestions and shared me his experience on what he did and what his sponsor walked him through. And we got to the fourth step. And, you know, I know people say that it's tough for them, but it was easy for me. There was only like six things on my list. It was great. I took it to my sponsor, and he looked at me, and I could see in his eyes that he knew I was full of shit. And we went over it, and as we're going over it, he still didn't tell me that I was full of shit. He started asking me questions. And well, I had been sober long enough to where I started doing this, you know, this whole how thing. I started being honest. And so I would answer the questions honestly, and he's like, don't you think that should be on there? I'm like, oh yeah, maybe. Yeah, it probably should be. So I ended up redoing my fourth step. And it was like from that moment on, like something inside of me, you know, I'm going to say a power greater than myself, allowed me to be willing to put more into myself, to my recovery, you know. So I did a thorough fourth step. And the funniest thing happened. After I did my fifth step from doing a thorough fourth step, like, I woke up one day and I realized that I wasn't obsessing over alcohol. Like, I was like, and I don't remember what day it was. Like, I didn't just like, oh, I don't want to drink today. I just woke up and I was like, yeah, I didn't think about drinking yesterday. And that was like the first promise for me. Like the first part of, you know, the promises that do come true in these rooms. And, you know, and so on and on. And we went and, you know, I was able to, you know, finished my 12 steps the first time through, and you know, I was able to make some amends that I didn't want to make, but I made them. And you know, I've been lucky because everyone I've had to make amends to has accepted my amends, and I know that sometimes that isn't always the case. Regardless, as alcoholics, we have, you know, our part is to keep our side of the streets clean, and if they don't accept that, then we have to accept that. I've learned a lot in these past 3 years, and I've gained a lot. Like, you know, I have a really good relationship with my son who's going to be 12 in March, and I'm like, okay, stop growing. You know, but he trusts me, and he's not scared of me, and he knows that I'm going to take care of him. You know, and I have people that can call me, and they know that I'm dependable today, which I definitely wasn't. I also learned that alcohol isn't my only problem, and it's really not a problem for me anymore. I'm the problem, you know. But like it says in chapter 5, you know, and thank you, Joshua, for pausing so I could say what's the point, because it is. The point for me anyway is to be willing to grow along spiritual lines. Like, and that's where I'm at today. Like, I know I'm not perfect, and I know I have a lot to work on. But as long as I'm willing to work on it, then I have a chance. Like, we all have a chance, you know? I don't know how long I've talked, but I have a few more things I'd like to say. I'm really not trying to be funny, I swear. Do I got something on my face?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. You should have told me before I started. Yeah, well, you know. But I've learned a lot in recovery. This old-timer up in Portland, Oregon, he said something, and it really hit home. And he said, whatever you put in front of recovery, you're going to lose. And that, like, that made a lot of sense to me. You know, because before, when I was sort of trying to be clean, it was like, well, you know, I got to take care of my family, and I got to, you know, I got to go to work, you know, and, you know, I got to pay my bills. But it's like, if I don't do my recovery, I'm not going to have a family. I'm not going to have that job to be able to pay those bills. Like, it's not possible. You know, and the cool thing about it is my son, and there's a few of you that have met my son, and I'm very blessed to have him. He's very supportive of his dad and his recovery, and he tags along with me most times. If it wouldn't have been so cold, he would have rode up on the motorcycle with me today, but he was like, nah, I'm staying in bed. And, you know, so that's the deal. Like, whatever you put in front of recovery, you're going to lose. Like, today I'm working on a degree in psychology. I will have my AA in 2020. And so for 4 semesters now, I've carried a 4.0 grade point average. I never thought that was possible. I take care of my responsibilities, you know, but I do still say what's on my mind. I don't ever try to hurt nobody's feelings, but, you know, I was raised, you shouldn't beat around the bush, and, you know, so I don't. So a good friend of mine gave me the nickname No Chill Charles, and so there you have it. But if you're new, welcome. You know, this is home. Welcome home. Like, seriously. You know, if you get the big book and you read it, I recommend you start on page 112 and read the first 3 words. That's it. It'll tell you how to read the rest of it. Get a sponsor, work the steps, and be of service, you know. Someone asked me to do this morning, and I was like, yeah. In my mind, I was like, you know, we were talking before, and it was like one of my friends said something about the spotlight. And I was like, no way. But, you know, when someone asks, and I was told that you don't say no. If it's not going to put yourself in harm, you know, I got to give it away because it was given to me. You know, I don't know if anything I've said has, you know, helped anybody with something they might have been going through. But I will tell you this, there's nothing or no one worth drinking over. And there's nothing or no one that's going to that a drink's going to make it any, you know, any better. Like, it's still bad out there. I had a rough year last year, but I'm still sober. You know, death in the family, financial situations, you know, but I'm still sober. And if I wasn't sober, I would be in a worse position than I am today. So, you know, if you're new, keep coming back. If you're a guy, get some guys' numbers. If you're a girl, get some girls' numbers. Pick up the phone. It gets lighter each time you use it, I swear. It does. Like, it's heavy the first time, but it gets lighter. And with that, I'm going to shut up, and we're going to go smoke, and then y'all can come back and listen to someone better than me talk. Thanks. All right, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. No, it's not that long. All right, so it is my pleasure now to introduce today's main speaker, Ben, who's going to come up and share some experience drinking help with us.
Thank you. Okay. Here we go. I guess I got a full hour. Good grief. My name, by the way, my name is Ben Benedetti. I'm an alcoholic. Here we are. I'm not sure about this, but I'm going to do the very best I can. Charles. Charles, yeah, right? Where'd he go? You were great. Experience, strength, and hope. He said, Charles, I thought you said something especially funny. You said, if I drank again, I'd be in a little worse trouble. I'm sure that's an understatement. You know, just a little worse trouble. All right. Well, I come from a place, a faraway land called Santa Clarita, which is down south, just north of L.A. in the San Fernando Valley. And I've lived out there since 73. So I've been out there a while. It's a wonderful, wonderful little small little town that just keeps getting bigger and bigger. And I live there with the love of my life there. And what a treat that we all get to, that we have been invited up here. I want to thank especially Brent and his wife and Bill and Julie and the people who we went out to dinner last night and had fun down here. And what hospitality and just what a wonderful blessing to get to be a part of something where people are honest and sincere and there's no axes to grind. There's no real agenda other than learning how to live. Live today. Just learning how to live today. I wasn't very good at living in the past. And I haven't been great or perfect at doing the sobriety thing either. It's, they talk about, you know, there's no wrong or right way really to do this. It's just about who's left. And if you're a hope to die drunk like me, I'm super grateful. I got sober. My sobriety date, just because Charles mentioned it, my sobriety date is May 1st, 1989, which just makes me old. That's all that does. It just makes me really old, and I've survived this long, and I'm coming up on 30 years of sobriety, and that just blows me away. I am. If that doesn't impress you, it impresses the shit out of me. It really does. There was a time in my life where I could not imagine, nor did I care to even want to imagine being life sober, having life sober, having a sober life. I loved alcohol. I loved the effect produced by alcohol. And it's only by the grace of God. It's only by the grace of God that I'm standing here today. So I'm just going to talk a little bit about, you know, how it was, what happened, and what it's like today. And today, my life is filled with a lot of incredible blessings. It's funny, Charles mentioned, you know, something that's kind of universally true. If you're a real alcoholic, I have found that most real alcoholics remember their first drink. And for me, it was not a big deal. It was like my very first time my lips touched alcohol. I think I was 13 years old. And that's the other universal truth, although Charles was a youngin at age 8. But usually around the ages between 12 and 14, 15, we seem to cross that line where alcohol becomes an incredible priority and becomes the solution in our lives. And for me, that's what happened. But when I first drank alcohol, I went to a little school called Hart High School in Newhall, California. And there was all, I would see these notices about parties and BYOB, and I'm like, what in the world does that mean? So I went to my parents, and I wanted to be cool, and I desperately wanted to fit in with the rest of the cool crowd, whatever that was. But I just felt separate. I just felt like I never fed in. And I've also discovered, and this is how I kind of share, and I'm going to bounce around a lot, and hopefully it'll make sense to someone. You know, we talk about the isms in this program. We talk about, at least we do in my neck of the woods, but you'll hear about the isms. And one of the isms is that is commonly referred to is that, you know, feeling like you're an alien dropped on this planet by mistake, you know, that you don't fit in, that and that alcohol alleviated all that. Why? I kind of not necessarily, you know, yes, I had that problem, and yes, alcohol became my solution and all that, but alcohol, my allergy to alcohol makes me an alcoholic. There's a unique set of genetic, whatever it is, circumstances, things that happen inside the body of an alcoholic that is unique to alcoholics. It doesn't happen to a lot of normal people, but I know plenty of normal people, again, whatever that is, but I know a lot of really normal people who also felt like they didn't fit in high school, felt like that, you know, we don't have a monopoly on isms or whatever. And I guess what I'm saying is that, you know, it's really up to you to decide if you're an alcoholic. There's no one here that can diagnose you. I got a pretty good idea about some of you. Like some of the folk that I had dinner with last night, oh yeah, there's some real alcoholics there. But but you also, you know, the first time I got there, I knew. You know, there was no denying it. There was no, it became my higher power. I worshiped King Alcohol, like the big book talks about. I worshiped King Alcohol, and I was completely, you know, the shivering denizens of his mad realm and all that. It was, I was completely on board with it, and I was completely fine with it. It was great. But the first time I had alcohol, it was a Mickey's Big Mouth, and I went to my parents and I asked them, could I have a party? You know, all these kids have parties, and I thought, you know, I'm sure it wasn't like that. I was 13, I could barely speak, but they said, okay, sure, why don't you come over? We had a pool, and so I called my friends on the soccer team, and I said, hey, I'd like to have a party. Do you guys want to come over? And the guy on the phone, I'll never forget it, he said, well, who's bringing the beer? And I'm like, you can, if that's what you want. So he brought a six pack of Mickey's Big Mouth, and I tasted it, and it was like, didn't taste good, so no thanks, and away it went. So that's not the first drunk I had. It was a couple years later. I was over at a friend's house, and he and his parents were out, and so we were just hanging out, and he said, hey, you want to take some shots from my parents' liquor cabinet? And of course, sure, you know, right? And the answer is always, yeah, sure, of course. And we started with Jack Daniels. I remember that. And it was, you know, poured a shot and I took it and I didn't know what to expect. You know, I don't think I even put two and two together that Mickey's Big Mouth had alcohol in it. I didn't know, you know, up until that point, it was milk, soda, alcohol, what's the difference? I didn't know. My only kind of vision of alcohol was like the pistolero coming off the plains, getting off his horse and, you know, saddling up to the bar, coming through the saloon, the doors going pat behind him and walking up to the bar, bartender, give me a shot of whiskey. And, but I didn't know that alcohol had an effect. I didn't know that my life was about to change irrevocably forever for the rest of my life. I didn't know that that was going to be a turning point in my life. And because I truly believe that my life is basically broken up into three points, or three or four now distinct areas of my life. Before alcohol, with alcohol, and without. And I would say even in the last decade or so, there's been such significant spiritual growth in my life that it's taken on a whole new chapter. But that's for later. He gave me the shot. It went down. It burned, you know, up through the sinuses and steam out the ears. And it was like, and it just was, oh, it, you know, you've all felt it. And it was like, oh God, I'm just like, it was horrible. It was awful. It was just, oh, and it burned and it was, ah, you want another one? Sure. You know? And I had my first blackout. I didn't know what that was, but it was great. It was great. I remember laying on the couch singing, and I'm not a singer, but just singing at the top of my lungs and happy. And it was just wonderful. And at some point, you know, it's all blurry, but at some point he said, my parents are going to be home. You got to go. And he literally threw me out the door. And I remember walking home and the earth is doing this and I'm trying to walk and Got home, and my mom just said, "Have you been drinking?" And I said, "Yeah, may I have a little?" And she said, "Why?" She just told me to go to bed. And I loved it. I loved the effect produced by alcohol. I found the answer to all the questions that I didn't even know I had. You know, I had I actually, in retrospect, I used to think that, you know, when I got sober, again in the late 80s, 90s, there was a strange time. Every television star and every TV show had a sober person in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was very fashionable to be sober in those days. And on every corner there was a rehab and a care unit it was a strange time, and the old timers just hated it. You know, all you spin dry alcoholics are going to come out, you know, and there was a lot of old crusty old timers, and I was young, and but I'm just so grateful for what I found. I'm just so grateful for what it took for me. Let me just tell you a little bit more about my drinking career, because it was pretty spectacular. I was really good at drinking. There was something, you know, my tolerance went up. I was a Bud man. I drank Budweiser by the case, and I was proud of it. And back in those days, it was Spud McKenzie, and you know that little pit bull dog, and the Bears. There's a Super Bowl shuffle and all that. Just stupid fun stuff. And my life, my father was the dean of the theater school of a pretty famous school down there in Santa Clarita called CalArts. And how that plays into my life is that there was a lot of unsaid expectations of success. Of implied that you can make, you know, that basically people rose to the level of their brilliance, and that you know, if you do right, good things will happen, and that there was definitely just a level of success and an expectation. And I ended up getting to go to that school mainly on his good name. And they let me in because of my name, because of my last name. I really do think that, because I had, by that time, throughout my whole last 2 years of high school, I think there's like 180 days of school, and I was at like maybe 40 of them at most. I was the kid that was crying, although most of my day, I was always at Saturday school, I was always at summer school, I was always trying to make up, and I was brilliant at being able to talk my way out of anything. And I actually graduated from high school with a 1.2 grade point average, and I admire your 4.0, but that's what sobriety gets you. And it was just a merciful, because they could tell I was kind of at least, if not smart, at least capable. And I was always telling, you know, being able to manipulate my way out of convincing the counselor that that's never going to happen again. And they were always telling me, if you just applied yourself better and if you just did this or whatever. And I just never could, because I would get there at first period, and I always made first period was my art class, because that was something that I could just skate through. And then by second period, I had a friend who lived down the street, and I was heading over to his house, and he had already graduated high school, and we had a whole thing. It was called the Mindless Club. And, we would get mindless all day long and watch The Price is Right and Get Smart and, all those daytime programming. We had a theme song and everything. We used to play guitars, and I too, I loved your respect that you showed by not talking about the other substances in your life, and I do believe in real alcoholism, but there are a lot of other substances in my story as well. And for me, I look at those substances as seasoning. I used all my other I used all my other substances very alcoholically. And it was just seasoning to add to the mix. And so I had a lot of different seasons that I tried, a lot of different flavors, and whatever could get me there. And so I somehow graduated high school, and I somehow got admitted into this college. And the college is actually an amazing school. And I found out real quickly that you just can't just kind of lie your way through college like you can in high school, or at least how I found I was able to in high school. And of course, my drinking and seasoning got worse and worse as it went along. So my ability to get by just was horrible. And what ended up happening during that first year in college is that I ended up having to drop out before they kicked me out. And I haven't really talked to my dad a whole lot about it, but I can only imagine just the shame and how he must have felt with his son, his bright son who he loved dearly, you know, goes into the school that he's so immensely well respected at, became just an utter failure, just a total. And I take full responsibility for my alcoholism and everything that I did. I was a dirtbag failure. I mean, I have no shame about that today. For many years, and I'll talk about the difference between shame and guilt, but for many years, my world was just covered with shame, and I didn't even know it. It was something that motivated me for a lot of years of my sobriety, and I have found freedom from that today. But I can only imagine how my dad felt when I went through that. And so I did the next best thing I could do after I got kicked out of college, that I was going to find, okay, it's finally, this is my turn, and I finally got to do it my way. And I ended up getting a job at a local gas station because that was the best I could do. It's pump gas. And it was a perfect job for me. The mechanic who worked there was my drug dealer, my seasoning dealer. So all I had to do was make it. He got in at 8 a.m. So, and my shift started at 6. All I had to do was get there at 6 and be present until 8 o'clock. There was no computers or anything. It was just a cash till, and I could take whatever cash out of the drawer I needed. And I needed a lot, and do what I got to do. And I would work till 2. And my life just became, you know, that Groundhog Day, that horrible, just awful thing over again. I had this uniform that I had to wear, and after some time, I got what I thought was a promotion. I became the lube oil mechanic, and I think honestly, it was just the owner wanted to keep me away from the customers, so he stuck me in the bay, and I used to change the oil. If you ever had your oil changed in Newhall, California, in 1987 to 1988, I apologize. Whether or not if you got all the quarts of oil or whatever in your car, there's no telling. I don't know. I was a mess. Towards the end of my drinking and using, I could barely speak in complete sentences. I was just this guy. I'd pump gas. All I had to do was ask him, "Do you want me to check your oil?" That's the only communications I had to have with people. I would stand there. It was a full service, back in the day when there was full service gas stations, and clean the windshield. And occasionally a Budweiser truck would drive by, and I would stand up and salute. And I love Budweiser. And then I would go change some oil. And I started getting in trouble. I started getting in trouble with the police. I also became a real adrenaline junkie. I was into anything that would take me out of my head. Anything. And I didn't know how to, I really wanted to impress you people, but I didn't know how to just like have a conversation. So I would do crazy stuff like drive 100 miles an hour down the street. And we used to just go out in the middle of nowhere, out into the hills, and just have big bonfires and drink, and, you know. I got in a lot of car wrecks. I got in 2 head-on collisions, and I got in one time after a whole night of sitting around one of those campfires out in the middle of nowhere, I was in the back of a pickup truck, and we were heading out. We used to drive down the freeway, up to these places, and there was always only one cooler of beer. But, okay, so the cooler beer is over in this truck, and we would just hop from one truck to the other, going down the freeway 60, 70 miles an hour, is just grab a beer and hop back into the other truck, you know. That was a common, all-the-time kind of stupid thing that we would do. We're going along after camping out. It was the morning after, so we're all a little groggy. There was a cute girl in the front of the pickup truck, and I'm sitting there, and I think I had already had a couple beers, and this is just one example of my life in those days. And so she was there and just doing this thing with the wind in her hair, in her hand in the wind, you know, and we're doing about 35 down this dirt road, and I figured I'd hang off the side of the truck and reach up and grab her hand, you know, grab her arm and give her a yah, just because I, you know, because that's the kind, I was a thrill seeker. And when I reached like that, for whatever reason, the guy in the truck swerved, so I'm airborne. And I just remember the sound of hitting the gravel. And when you're an adrenaline junkie like that, there's this stasis where your body just takes over in situations. And tuck and rolled and rolled off into the bushes and stood up. And I'm just like, holy cow. I didn't say it like that. But, and they're just driving on down the road, had no idea that I had fallen out. And I'm like, hey! Oh. And they pulled over. I literally had rocks sticking out of my forehead. I still have the scars on my shoulders. And just hamburger meat. And I'd love to tell you that that was a one-time thing. But it was not. It was consistently. My nickname became Ben the Fool. And it was that they would be calling each other and just say, you'll never believe what Ben did this time. And lots of plastic surgery, lots of all kinds of stuff, just because that's where this keen intellect, this great, brilliant head of mine takes me. That's my best thinking. And it's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. My last DUI was I borrowed my friend's Jeep, and I was going over to the seasoning house, and I pulled out of a parking lot, got sideways in his Jeep, and right about, you know, the wheels locked up and launched me right into a parked car, and his Jeep ended up on top of this car, and I'm just so grateful that there was no one walking on the sidewalk, because they would have been done for. And that night I put on a great, you know, one more poor me, and the cops still locked me up regardless. And that was about as brilliant. That was, you know, that was the sum of my drinking career. Got me to that high a point. And for the next year, it was court date after court date, extension after extension, because I just couldn't get my court card signed. I had two or three different court cards that I had to get signed. My first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, my first DUI was when I was 15. And my last DUI was when I was 18. And that last DUI, according to the booking sheet, was October 31st, Halloween. I didn't even know it was Halloween. I really didn't. I had no idea. It was just another night. But I didn't get sober until May of the following year. And this is all looking at my record and when I had this, actually got sober and had to start cleaning up the records of my past. But I couldn't, that's 7 months, I couldn't tell you what happened. There's some recollection of there must have been some holidays, and I always spent every holiday with my family, and there's pictures and photographs to say I was there, but I wasn't there. And my moment of clarity, was in April. I had been told by the judge, this is your last extension. You need to get and back in those days it was nothing. I had to get 6 signatures and a couple hundred hours of community service. I mean, these days, you know, I know they throw the book at you, but I couldn't even do that much. And the judge said, you know, next time I see you, you're either going to jail or you got that court card filled out. And I woke up one morning, and what I had become was again, this creature, this, I was just like this golem-like creature, you know, my precious, you know, I couldn't communicate, like I said, I couldn't talk, I was just dark, shrunken, I worked on cars all day. And if you're light, if you have that kind of job and then as soon as you get off, there's way too many seasonings and alcohol to drink and everything like that. The showers just get in the way. So I hadn't showered in who knows how long. I'm wearing this. I would just go to bed in my uniform, get up and go to work and go, you know, it was disgusting. I was a disgusting, hopeless creature. And I woke up one morning and there's just these two eyes and blackness and darkness, because I always made it to work. But I woke up that morning and I realized, oh, crap. I said, oh, shit. You know, yesterday was my court date. Didn't make it. Didn't realize until that morning. And my moment of clarity was that somewhere, at some point, at some meeting, and we have it at most meetings where it says, I am responsible. And for members of Alcoholics Anonymous, it's, I am responsible for the hand of AA to always be there. But for me, at that moment, the words, I am responsible, like I couldn't blame anyone else anymore. I had screwed my life up so completely. And I, more than that, because I think, you know, some people like this, it's shared. I think there's a lot of myths in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm going to talk a little bit about that later. But one of the myths of Alcoholics Anonymous is that every alcoholic needs to hit their bottom. And I think alcoholics just get comfortable in their bottom. We'll just bounce along as long as it takes. And I don't know what gets me or keeps me sober, or we'll just lower the bar, you know? Those yets get worse and worse and worse. I've dealt with so many people who say, oh yeah, no, this is as bad as I ever want it to be. This is as bad. It can't get any worse. And I'm like, oh yeah, it can get worse. It can get so much worse. Oh no, 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 I'm done. 2 years later, you know, you get there. You get there. I do believe in the mysteries of life. I do believe that if God was big enough that I could understand him, that he wouldn't be big enough for my problem. And that I just have to be eternally grateful for the moments of sobriety that I have right now. It's called God's grace. God's grace. It's a gift that I did not deserve. You know, I want mercy. I need God's grace in my life. If I got what I deserved, well, I certainly would be locked up at the very least. You know? So I'm grateful to be here with you people here today. And if you are a newcomer and you're here today, we stop. We remove ourselves from the debating society. The whys and the what ifs and the what could have beens and all that are no longer our responsibility. Learning how to be just grateful for the gift of the present day today, I think, is the biggest and most important challenge that any alcoholic can have. And like Charles so eloquently said, there is nothing that alcohol isn't going to make worse. And it can and does get worse. So just stay. You're never going to get a better sobriety date than the one you have today. Flat out. Flat out. So I love my sobriety day today. I'm so grateful. Thank you, brother. It's all but the grace of God. Because I have tried, I've given it some really good efforts at screwing this thing up. The only thing I haven't done wrong is not drink. I've touched every fire. I've done everything wrong. The only thing I've done, what I've done is I trained my feet to keep coming to meetings. Where are your feet at? Your feet don't lie. You know, where are you at? And so my feet just show up. I go to meetings. I still go to 4 to 5 meetings a week, sometimes more. This week I actually went to less, but As a general rule, I have my home group that I go to, and I go to meetings. It's about the basics. It's about making my sobriety the very first priority in my life. And these are things that my sponsor taught me early on, is that sobriety has to be the most important thing in my life, no matter what, even more important than God. Because with no sobriety, there is no God. I mean, now, it's the old chicken before the egg. I can't stay sober without my God. That's just me. I came into this thing. My parents raised me with no God. My father in particular was raised in Chicago as a good Catholic boy. He was an altar boy. He was raised in that scenario. And then my mom was the whole Midwestern, punishing, grew up around her punishing, very racist, very, very, very difficult. So they both committed to not putting their children through what they were raised through. So, you know, as typical parents, we go to the complete opposite. I'm not going to do what my parents did, so I'm going to go over here, which, in fact, is just a direct reflection of there. It's just another side of the coin. Unfortunately, you don't learn that until you become a grandparent. But at any rate, but then you get to further break those chains just a little bit more. And I have two wonderful sons who are really, really great. My youngest son is autistic and is just a really interesting fellow. And I get to see him pretty regularly. But my oldest son, him and I are very close. And he has an amazing daughter. And I'm a grandfather now. And it's just this thing called life is just incredibly amazing and wonderful. But for a fixed pillar or drink, I could have missed all of that. All of this wonderful gifts in my life. What ended up happening is that I got in that wreck, I got that DUI, I missed my court date, and so what did I do? Good alcoholic, I ran to rehab. Because I was done. Honestly, I had that moment of clarity, that moment sitting at the sink, trying to get ready for work one more time, realizing that I had utterly destroyed my life. I'd become the complete antithesis of everything that my parents had ever raised me to be. I failed at seemingly everything that I tried. You know, the big book talks about if just a code of morals could keep us sober, many of us would have stayed sober long ago. The real concept of powerlessness, you know, I felt it that morning. And I believe that steps 1, 2, and 3 come together in a whole package. And I think we do it every time we go to a meeting. I wake up. I'm an alcoholic. Alcoholics Anonymous. There's something. I've been going to your meetings. I've seen the truth. You guys obviously drank, or you seemed to drink the way that I drank. You talked about drinking the way that I drink. You weren't lying, apparently. I didn't understand what the angle was, really. But I heard the truth in what you guys had to say. And so I came to believe that a power greater than myself might exist. I was willing to be willing. And that you guys seemed to have it. So I turned my will and my life over to the care of you people. Because I had nothing better to do. My way didn't work. And if you have any amount of reservation, just ask God to be willing to be willing. I don't like to say, if you have any amount of reservation, you're probably going to drink and you're probably going to die. But that is the truth. I've seen it 100 times, you know. Sadly, probably 50% of us are going to die drunk. The odds are so against us. This thing is truly miraculous. This thing, I can't never take for granted my sobriety. I can't say that enough. So I turned my will and my life over to the care of that rehab. I'm very fortunate that I went into a place that was very founded in the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. We had 2 big book studies a day, 2 12 and 12 studies a day. Then we had group therapy, and we went to a meeting at night. And it was 8-9 hours a day of intensive, just nose in the big book. And I didn't realize it at first. What I did that morning, I went into work. After I was staring at the mirror, and it wasn't my moment of clarity. I don't want you to take this wrong. It wasn't like the clouds didn't open up and the angels didn't sing or anything like that. It was just I felt desperate and miserable enough to pick up that phone when I got to work. It wasn't much, but it was just enough. And I have found that my God today gives me just enough. Sometimes that's just enough to suit up and show up to work. Sometimes that's just enough to have to pick up the phone and tell my dad that his mom died. You know, whatever it is that's in front of me, whatever those challenges, whatever those things are that seemingly seemed like too much for me to handle, God gives me just enough. And I got to work that morning and I picked up the phone and I had been introduced to this program months before because my parents were endlessly trying to help me stop doing what I was doing, you know. And they had taken me to this program. And I had that, and I met this guy in this hospital program. And for the first time, a person looked at me and told me my story. Like, I could tell that he knew me in a way. And the truth was that he was just another alcoholic who had been where I was sitting at. He looked at me and he said, well, I can tell you just hang out at work. You don't have much of a life. You probably just go to work and go home and get drunk and loaded all day and you have a miserable life and we have a way of helping you get out of that. Now, I'm sitting there in my uniform, disgusting, you know, the picture I painted earlier. I thought he was like reading my mind or whatever. That was pretty apparent what my life had become. We think that we're hiding in it from everyone. That no one knows how bad it really is. I hate to tell you, I hate to break it to you, but you aren't fooling anybody. Your parents, your family, your coworkers, they know. If you're a train wreck like I was, it's like, it's pretty apparent. At the very worst, you're not present most of the time. And that affects people. We have a bigger, you know, there's one of the other myths in Alcoholics Anonymous is that we have, you know, we're powerless over people, places, and things. That's completely not true. We have a direct effect on the people around us every single moment that we're present or not present. I can't control and manipulate everyone in my life. Yes, I'm powerless over people. They're not going to do or say exactly what I want them to say. If you're codependent like me as well. That's important to understand that. But, you know, we're so black and white, we like to think, oh, I'm powerless over people, places, and things. Or the worst things that alcoholics say is that I'm not hurting anyone else. It's only me. That is the worst lie we tell ourselves. The pain and suffering we put our families through is unbelievable. And, again, these are just either truths about yourself that you're going to be able to have to learn to accept. And I'm okay with it because I never want to be that creature ever again. I never want to go back to being that person ever again. I never want to go back to the person I was 5 years ago ever again. I'm a growing sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I still have no idea what I'm going to be when I grow up. But I'm learning how to be the best Ben I can be every day that I wake up. Every day that I touch God, and every day that I get close to God. excuse me. I went to that rehab. I sat and talked with that guy, and so I picked up that phone, and I said, "Hey, man, do you still have that bed available? I'm done. I can't do this anymore." He said, "Yeah, we'll have a bed available for you in a week." A week? Woo! Okay, I got a week to tie it on. For me, my favorite place in the world is Sequoia National Park. So I went and got a gallon of Cuervo Gold and we went up and I don't remember hardly any of it, but I came back down and I'm sitting with my last Budweiser that morning. It must have been April 31st, I guess, 1989. My dad was coming to pick me up. My license had been revoked, you know, years ago. So he was coming to pick me up to give me a ride. down to this place in Buena Park. And I'm sitting there caressing that Budweiser. My most intimate relationship was with my Budweiser. Again, back to the whole thing, if it was a mere code of morals or just being good could make me sober. You know, for years, I tried to do the right thing. For years, I would try to do good or be good. And so after a while, I just gave up and I was just going to be bad. And then that turned and I started to believe that I was just no good. And I carried that burden for quite a long time of just feeling no good. No matter how hard I tried, I always failed. I was only going to drink a 12-pack. I was only going to drink, you know, I wasn't going to make a complete ass out of myself. I wasn't going to fail here. I wasn't going to fail there. And I always did. So I'm sitting there on the couch that morning, drinking my last beer, and tears, I think, were coming out of my eyes, just thinking, what am I going to do without you? Because there was nothing in my life that I didn't do without it. And thank God, I got put into a place where they really taught me and showed me how to have fun in sobriety. Working in the kitchen, you know. What a wonderful breakfast, by the way, guys. Really, thank you. Thank you. That was really good. These things are fun. I get such a kick out of being a service today. I'm a service junkie. I don't mess around. We got a central office down in Santa Clarita that I help out with. We got a convention. We have special events there's so much fun to have in Alcoholics Anonymous with a group of people, all with a common purpose of how to get sober and stay sober one day at a time. So I went down to this place. It turns out this place in Buena Park was for people who have other things issues to deal with. So I ended up being locked up there for quite a long. It was in the scope of things. It wasn't all that long. It was worth every minute. And they were so focused on Alcoholics Anonymous. It was great. But there was all the people doing the Thorazine shuffle and all that stuff. You know, it was a special place. But it was exactly where I needed to be, and I was there for 67, 68 days. And they kept me in there until I didn't want to go. And I was really kind of scared to leave. And the first place I went when I left there was a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, the very first place. Before I went home, before I did anything else, I knew that I had to make this thing my number one priority. And I had to do it. And so I went to my first meeting at the Rafters in Newhall, California, and I have been pretty much going ever since. Now, what I have found is that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful, and the insanity returns, and then we drink. And I went up to, I had all the answers. I knew everything I needed to know to stay sober for the rest of my life. Now, alcoholics have a way of twisting the truth, of twisting reality. We do it, as a survival mechanism when we're drinking and using. It talks about it in the doctor's opinion that the alcoholic's reality becomes the only one. You know, it becomes, occasionally he will tell the truth and he won't be able to say why he drinks, right? That we have a way of twisting reality to meet our needs. And that's why we have to learn to start aligning our will with God's will. Because we aren't even, I'm not even aware that I'm doing it. Because my intentions are usually good, don't you know? So what I ended up doing was that I went to meetings for about about 18 months. I went to meetings. And, the insanity returned. I went running up to a meeting. I was so blessed to get sober. There was a guy named Phil Stone who sobered a lot of people and was just a really great, one of these great old timers. And he died shortly after that with 39 years of sobriety. And I went running up to the rafters one night because it was blatant. I was obviously something wasn't working. Now, I hadn't taken a real step. I hadn't actually worked the program. I was doing the old two-step, 1 and 12, 1 and 12. Being of service, staying sober, going to meetings. But, you know, that four-step, that seemed a bit extreme. I went running up to the rafters. That it was a late at night, and Phil generally wasn't at late night meetings, but he was there that night. And I went up to him. I said, "Hey, Phil. Oh my God, I'm so glad to see you. I'm just, I don't know. I'm just going nuts. I'm feeling thirsty. I need help." He said, "Okay, kid. Let's after the meeting, we'll go and talk. We'll go talk down in the parking lot after the meeting. We'll talk." I said, "Oh." He's going to give me the secret handshake. He's going to give me the whatever. He's going to finally give me the secret, this thing. Because I don't get it. You want me to believe in a God that I can't see? An invisible God that I can't see or feel or hear? Or how is reading a book? I've got all this community service to do. I got this to do. I got that to do. How is me attending meetings? I don't understand. So he's finally going to tell me the secret. And I love that man. And so we sit. I don't remember anything about the meeting, of course, because I'm waiting to get the secret. And back in those days, we talked about it last night. You know, there was smoking in the meetings. It was different. In wonderful and not so wonderful ways, but it was different. So we waited, and there was also a thing called parking lot sobriety, and there's still some of that. He said, the meeting finished. I'm standing there. I'm antsy. I want to talk to Phil. I said, "Phil, come on, let's go." He said, "Okay, come on, kid. Let's go talk." We go down, and we're in the parking lot, and the parking lot's already cleared out. Everyone's kind of left to go home, and it is just covered with cigarette butts, right? He said, "Okay, kid, you grab that trash can. I'll grab this one. Let's clean up this parking lot. This needs to be straightened up." Okay, we're going to clean up, and then he's going to give me the secret. I can wait. I can do this. And I also remember, though, just feeling, oh, my, because Phil was one of these people, you can't help it. At least when I was a newcomer, you couldn't help but just put those old-timers up on pedestals. You know, I just admired this guy. He talked about God. He talked about things that I didn't understand. But those old-timers, to me, they had a magic of just making you feel special. You know, like, just letting you know that it's going to be okay. No matter what you go through, right? It's just going to be okay. And I just felt so grateful that he was taking this time to be with me. This guy that just felt no good. This guy that was convinced that he was just no good. And so we're picking up the cigarette butts, and I'm just heads whirling. And it took about, I think, 45 minutes to pick up all those, I mean, there's a lot of cigarette butts. We used to smoke. And we got done, and we stood there for a minute. He said, "Good job, kid." And I said, I do. He said, how do you feel now, kid? I said, I feel okay. He said, "You going to stay sober?" And I said, "Yeah, I think I'll stay sober tonight." He said, "Okay, I'll see you tomorrow." That was it. And he gave me the gift of service. He gave me the gift of being of service, of thinking of others, of cleaning up, of getting out of my head long enough. Because, see, I'm a victim. I'm trapped in my... I have this trap that only thinking of others and being close to God can spring the trap. I can't undo it myself. I need your help. I really need your help. And so that was one of the gifts that Phil gave me. And I've been on this road of being of service ever since. And shortly thereafter, I started reading the big book again. If you're new, I highly encourage you to read the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And maybe not for the reason that you might think. Obviously, I think all the answers are there. I think the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, is a divinely inspired book. Phil had like 2 or 3 years of sobriety when him and the group of people wrote it. They didn't have steps. They didn't have the organization like we have. They didn't have the blessings that we have, where I can drive out here to Springville, California and attend a meeting like this. Or I can pick up the phone for central office and find a meeting when I need it, or whatever. In L.A., where we come from, there's over 3,000 unique and individual meetings every week. That means that you can go to a meeting every day, go to a different meeting for 10 years. Never go to the same meeting for one day. That's how many meetings there are in the L.A., greater Los Angeles area. What a blessing. What a wonderful gift. There's no reason for... So for me, meeting makers make it. There's two things that I can depend on today, and I'm so grateful, because they didn't have it back there when they wrote that book originally. But I can depend on that there's always going to be a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. You see, the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous, the real thing that changed the world, and I'm just knowing the history of mental wellness in the world, Alcoholics Anonymous and the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous have changed the world. And the 12 traditions. There's no leadership? What? You know, we're all here. Well, we're also very fortunate that we're all here because we don't want to die. At least not today. And not an alcoholic death. Today, I just want to stay sober, and it maybe, and the key to my sobriety is helping you. Because that's the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous. See, Dr. Bob and Bill, and for 7,000 years of recorded human history before that, there was brief glimpses. Yes, there was the Washingtonians. They had some good sobriety. There's a couple other organizations that had some good sobriety for a brief period, but they lost their way and fell apart. And Alcoholics Anonymous is the only thing that has held steady and helped people like us, like me, stay sober one day at a time. And it's all about helping someone else. You have to give this thing away in order to keep it. We're like miners who have struck the mother lode. And I love that saying in the big book, we can't reap the benefits unless we give away all the proceeds. And it's so great. My sponsor got sober on June 16th, 1965, and his sponsor got sober in 1958. He just got 60-something years of sobriety. I'm so grateful for my sobriety and for the legacy and for just the examples of sobriety. About coming up on 10 years ago, my best buddy, a guy named Scott, he was my best friend. If you're like me, it takes a lot to get close to people. It takes a lot to actually open up and become like, to have the commitment of really having friendship, real friendship. And I had a good friend, and him and I started a little convention together down there in Santa Clarita. You're welcome to join. It still happens every year. And I depended on him, and he depended on me. And he was a rascally kind of guy, though, too. He was a lot of fun. And he and I walked this path together a lot. And one day, his dog was in the way in the kitchen, and he went to shoot it away or to kick the dog. And he lost his balance and fell and hit his back on the refrigerator. And it was a pain that he'd never felt in his life before. And he found out, and he went to see the doctor, and the doctor ran some tests. And a few months later, they weren't for sure, but it was, he had spinal cancer, spinal cord cancer. And it was, this is a very long story told short, but, and I'm not sure where I'm going with it, but these are the kind of things that we go through together, you know? And I was there with his wife and him when the doctor told him, yes, it's cancer. And we took everything out that we could, but to take any more out, you'd be a quadriplegic and there's nothing we can do. And he went through the chemo and the radiation for a couple of months, but he was just sick all the time. And he had two little beautiful little kids. One of them just turned 18 a couple of days ago. And he just decided to stop the treatment and live his life for as long as he could. And I got to be there with him. And we got together and I made a videotape with him of, you know, him talking to his kids, you know, for when they grow up. just the wonderful blessings that, you know, and I got to be there when, not exactly when he took his last breath, but I was there that night. And after I left, he passed on just a couple hours later. And I got to watch my best friend, you know, die sober with grace and dignity, and wasn't on probation, wasn't in trouble anymore. And he was a beautiful man when he passed on. And I still know his wife and I still know his kids. I don't see them all that often, but I mean, it's just this wonderful family that we get to be a part of. And as I said earlier, when I go to meetings, I know that I'm an alcoholic. I'm powerless over alcohol. I need you people. I need Alcoholics Anonymous way more than Alcoholics Anonymous needs me. I need you guys in my life. You guys give me strength where I don't have it. And as a result of all that, and these friendships and these wonderful blessings, and that was already, gosh, like I said, like 10, 12 years ago. Actually, it was probably more like 14 years ago that Scott passed on. What I found out recently and in just the last few years is, and that Thayer and I were talking about a little bit this morning, is this weird thing called emotional sobriety. Bill Wilson talks a little bit about it in the 12 and 12. In the 12th step, he talks about that we will gain emotional sobriety. And I didn't even know it. Like, I would go to counseling. You know, I believe in getting outside help. I believe in getting all the help we can get. There was an old bugger named Tony that moved to Arizona. And he used to say, how do you stay sober today? Any effing way you can. Okay? Flat out. Whatever it takes, sobriety has to be number one. I don't know if you remember Tony, but it was, yeah. And he didn't, So I don't know exactly what it is that keeps me sober today. I really don't. And I have a better understanding about God than I used to. But in a real, real sense, I have a God of my misunderstanding today. Okay? Like I said earlier, if God was small enough for me to understand him, he wouldn't be big enough for my problem. And so today, in the last few years, I've learned how to start having feelings. And it, for me, I'm a slow learner. I don't know what to tell you, but it took me like 25 years to get to the point where you reach these plateaus in your sobriety. And so I may not be talking directly to the newcomers now, but it still applies. You reach these plateaus and you'll reach these points in your sobriety where you either grow or you go. And the road narrows. And the crap that I used to get away with in my earlier sobriety, I just can't do anymore. I have to get away from the things I've been getting away with. And a lot of that had to do with my ability to feel feelings. I used to run away from my feelings. Like the minute a feeling came on, it's like, oh, I got to go do this. I got to do this. There's got to be something else I can fix. I'm a fixer. I'm a fix. And as soon as, when I first took that drink and felt like I got there, I became a fixer. I became a fixer. There has to be something I can do to fix this, whatever this is. And usually, I never knew it, but it was this feeling, whatever it was. And I went through a period about a few years ago where I started feeling feelings because I really had no other choice. And I cried and cried. I cried for months, it seemed like. And I think it was months. And you know what? It didn't kill me. And I had to just feel it. I didn't. And it was really important for me not to analyze it. Not to try to figure it out. Did my mom drop me on my head? Or was there a reason for this? Or they just maybe they neglected me a little bit too much here? Or they didn't give me my fair share of whatever? Or whatever. It was just feel the feelings. And I have discovered that God is an organic part of me as much as God is a part of that tree. And God is either everything or He is nothing. And that the feelings are gifts from that higher power. And you just have to experience it and walk through it. And I don't know what your lesson might be for whatever feelings that you might be trying to hide from. But you just got to feel it. Whether you got to cry, you know, those horrible, really demoralizing, humiliating crying where the boogers are coming out of your nose and whatever, you know, and just don't worry about any, because you cannot save your ass and your face at the same time. And it's been really beautiful that I can feel feelings today, and it has really opened up my life to and broadened my horizons and given me so much more to enjoy today. And to just experience all the beauty that there really is to experience. And I think I've talked enough, but I hope I've said something. Newcomers, please keep coming back no matter what, no matter what, no matter what. I've been through a lot of no matter what's. And I'm so grateful to all of you that have helped me in so many ways. Thank you.